Cabernet tends to be the sort of Errol Flynn of the grape varieties.
The most expensive beer in history.
People will turn around to me and say, oh, I'm just making gin while I wait for my whiskey to get ready.
Because wine is an adventure.
Conventional winemakers who just condemn all natural wine as faulty.
The prestigious title of Sake Samurai.
Looking at whiskey in more of an artful culinary way.
They kind of look at it as a novelty more than anything. The guy from the rock bands is making wine.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine, and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Ortimus Spirits was founded by Australian Miko Abouaf in 2013 in the French city of Cognac. But the company has made its name on other spirits, like its flagship, Pink Pepper Gin, plus liqueurs, bitters, and offbeat experiments like Umami Spirit, created with ingredients including capers and Parmesan cheese. Ortimus's creativity and distilling prowess was recognised in 2020 at the Icons of Gin Awards when it was named Craft Producer of the Year. Full disclosure, it was Andrew Burge from our partner, the Gin Society, who suggested that Miko and his business partner, Ian Spink, would be great talent for the podcast. Andrew sold me pretty quickly on this interview, as I was very intrigued by the Ortimus story. I wanted to ask Miko how it was that an Australian could find himself distilling gin in Cognac.
It's a good question. So I grew up in Australia. My dad is French-Tunisian. My mum is first-generation Australian, but with a European background. And so I kind of grew up in a European bubble in Sydney. And the European tradition of making liqueurs, so infusing fruits in alcohol and leaving them for a few months and sweetening them, that was something that my mum did as a hobby, something that she inherited from her mother. And I used to help her do that. So, you know, going in and getting fruits from the garden or buying the fruits and peeling, cutting, leaving them, and that kind of alchemy of leaving them for a long time and coming back and tasting them. It was something that I just really loved. She transmitted that passion. And it's something that really stayed with me. So as I said, I did my university in Australia, moved over to London, lived and worked in London for a bit. And I was working in the city at the time. So I had a very short stint in the city of London, working in finance. And I'd kind of been working during the week, and on the weekends I'd go to the farmer's market and get a pile of apples, take them back to my flat and, grind them up, ferment them, distill them. And I had a little tiny still that I'd just be playing around with. So it's something that I'd always loved doing, that I'd done since I was a kid. And then I was about 25 years old. I'd just come back from, finished my master's. I did in London, traveled around, worked overseas for a bit, and then just realized that I wanted to do it as a profession. So I moved to France because I have family over here, and kind of based myself between a friend in Bordeaux and my grandmother's couch in Paris. And then I ended up getting a small bicycle, an old postman's bike actually, and traveling around, going from distillery to distillery. This was back in 2011, just looking for a distillery to get experience in. So I left from Bordeaux and kind of traveled around the Armagnac region up into kind of the region where they make a lot of fruit eau de vie, into Cognac, into the Calvados region, into the Absinthe regions, the fruit liqueur regions, just traveled around. And it was in Cognac that I ended up finding a job. In working for a distillery that we used to distill for Courvoisier and Martel, two of the big cognac houses.
I don't know a lot of cognac distilleries, but I know both those brands.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way that, well, I won't get too sidetracked into it, but basically the big cognac houses, they have their own distilleries, but they rely on hundreds of other distilleries that produce the eau de vie or the new make, which they then sell to the big cognac houses to do the aging and the bottling and the marketing and the selling and everything like that. So I used to work for this. It was quite a large distillery. We had 12 2,500-litre stills. And, you know, our job was literally to get the wine in, to distill it to perfection, and then to pass it on to Martel or Courvoisier so that they could then do that next step. So it was a really, really perfected way of distilling. And so from that, I just wanted to set up my own thing. Cognac was home. And so I decided to set up my own distillery, but focusing on spirits using plants and fruits and herbs, going back to my family tradition.
Your flagship product is gin. Had you already had sort of a particular passion for that spirit?
To be perfectly honest with you, no. I wouldn't say that gin was something that I was immediately passionate about. But what I was looking for was a type of spirit where you had a lot of freedom of expression. Again, you know, with cognac or whiskey or rum, whatever it's going to be, the way that you have to make it, it's a very, very well-defined and a very strict definition. Whereas with gin, of course, you have to have juniper as the core of the product, but then you're really free to express yourself in so many different ways. And I'm sure that this is something that, you know, your listeners of the podcast have heard 1,000 times, is that, you know, just that freedom of expression is just a really beautiful thing. And what I wanted to do was to be inspired by, you know, the aromas that were around me and the things that I love, the plants, the fruits, the herbs, and to be able to translate that from their natural state into a liquid state. And really, gin gives that really incredible freedom to be able to do so. So that's why I turned to gin. And to be perfectly honest with you, it was really quite coincidental that the gin boom was happening, particularly in the UK. It hadn't actually come to France yet. France were, you know, it was kind of in the tail end of the vodka market. The vodka boom, which in the UK kind of finished up about 5-10 years earlier, France was still happening. But then, you know, gin really just made sense.
So, Ian, how did you connect with Mikko and get involved with setting up Ordemus?
So, well, Mikko had already set up Ordemus when we met. I'd moved to the cognac region a few years before Mikko had. I did that very... I'm originally from Essex in the UK. I did that very British thing of buying an old ruined chateau or manor house here in the cognac region.
Oh, I've seen shows on TV about that.
Yes, yeah, there are now many shows on TV. They don't always depict the realism of going through it. I mean, it was a complete ruin. It was a 4-year project that, you know, myself and my now ex-partner did all ourselves. And it was a great thing to do. It was a really interesting thing to do, but I'd never do it again. So, I spent 4 years renovating that. I'd actually moved here from South America. I'd lived several years in South America before then. And after the renovation was finished, I started a soup company, a small soup business. I used to, you know, cook and sell soup in the local market. And one day, Mikko came in to buy some soup. Which was how we met. And, you know, it was actually really good to find somebody that spoke English, first of all. And, you know, my French is still pretty rusty. And he gave me one day a sample of this gin that he'd made, which was one of the first batches, I think the first batch of pink pepper gin. And to be honest with you, James, I was just blown away by it. You know, I have a love of alcohol, but my background is more from a consumer side. Not creating any spirits, and I'd never tasted anything like it before. I was completely blown away. And so, you know, Mikko and I, over a few months, we got to know each other. And, you know, my soup business was a winter job, and when the spring came around, I said, well, you know, I'll try and see if we can find a home for the gin in the UK. I had no idea about the alcohol industry and how it worked or anything. It was just, I just thought, look, I've got this great spirit and everyone else is going to love it because I love it. So I'm just going to go and sell it to the UK. And obviously the reality is very different, you know, finding distributors. And it was obviously the UK at that time was in the middle of a gin boom.
So, yeah, tell me what that was like, those early days when you went back to the UK and I guess you were kind of, you know, bringing coals to Newcastle or whatever people say.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, so Miko had already set up and found a distributor here in France. And so sort of armed with that, and as you say, taking a spirit like gin to the UK and trying to find a home for it was interesting. I was so naive. I was going around to bars thinking that every bar was an individually owned business. You know, aside from pub groups, I just assumed that all of these top bars in London were independently owned, which of course they're not. So, you know, I'm going around with gin to various places and speaking with the barman, and all the barmen loved it, but of course they're not the decision makers. And there's somebody that sits at the top of this bar group that, you know, they're the people that you have to meet. And there was a moment really out of desperation, I suppose. I was in the UK. I'd been there for about 10 days and I had two bottles of gin left with me. And I'd literally been going around everywhere, you know, sampling and getting some great reactions from everybody who I met. But I hadn't actually got a UK distributor at this point. So I had these two bottles left and I went into Selfridges, which is a, you know, quite a well-known department store in London. And they have, you know, a good alcohol selection. And I gave the two bottles to a cashier and I said, look, this is for you. You can keep this one. If you promise me you'll give the other one to the person that is responsible for buying alcohol for Selfridges. And I left both bottles with the cashier and he promised me that that's what he would do.
Bit of a gamble.
So, and, you know, a few weeks later, Dawn Davies, who at the time was the head buyer for Selfridges, she got in touch and said that she wanted to stock Pink Pepper Gin. That was the turning point for us, because once you have Selfridges behind you, all of the distributors in the UK actually were then interested in importing our spirit, because of course they want to supply Selfridges. So it very quickly turned around from, you know, struggling to find that distributor to all of the distributors wanting to work with us, which was, for me personally, was a really lovely moment. But yeah, it was definitely a learning curve, shall we say.
You look after the sales side of the business and Miko is more production, obviously.
Yeah, basically. It's not as clearly defined, I suppose, as that. But yeah, in broader terms, I would do the sort of commercial side of it, especially focusing on the UK market and in the other markets that were present. And yeah, Miko is the genius behind the creativity.
We're a small team, so there are four of us in the company. And yes, definitely the lines and the boundaries are blurred. So we've got Pip, who's been with us for quite a few years now, who's based in the UK. And does a lot of the groundwork of going around doing tastings and getting liquid on lips, as we call it. And then Maureen, who is based in Cognac, who really is just gives us a lot of support and looks after everything administrative and kind of is the organizer of a lot of things that are going on. So it's we're a small team, but that's pretty much how it's split up.
So Miko, tell me about Pink Pepper Gin. What's the origins of that product and the botanicals that you are working with there?
The aim in making Pink Pepper Gin was to create a really, really richly aromatic and bold style gin. So moving away from a London dry where it's really quite linear, you know, where you've got something that's very juniper led and it's kind of the same aromatic, whether you drink it in a martini or in a gin and tonic or on its own. I wanted to head into something that would really evolve in the glass. So over here in France, if you've ever tried Armagnac, when you're doing a tasting, they tell you to kind of let the glass warm up and you see how the aromas will really evolve. So you start off with something that's, you know, a bit apricotty and head into something that's a bit more kind of almost moss and rosy. And what I wanted to do was take a spirit that would evolve like that and put it into gin form. And that's kind of the aim in creating a sipping, gin de dégustation, a tasting gin that was also versatile. So it's built pretty much like a perfume where all of the botanicals are macerated separately, distilled separately, and then blended together. So at the top, you've got pink peppercorns, obviously, juniper and cardamom, which really give it a bright freshness to the top notes of the spirit. The core is made up of cinnamon and two other secret botanicals. And then at the base, there's distilled spring honey and tonka bean and vanilla macerations. So as you taste the gin, when you first have it to your nose, you'll see that there's really, really bright, fresh junipery and pink peppery notes that come through. And then as the spirit warms up and opens up, you'll kind of enter into a journey, if I'm going to be a bit wankish about it, and follow through this warming a warming experience where you'll end on really, really lovely patisserie notes of the tonka and the vanilla. We work with vacuum distillation, which I think is starting to come to Australia. There are a few gins or a few bars that have rotary evaporators. And that's what I started with. So it's actually laboratory equipment that's used to create distillates of botanicals, individual botanicals. So when you're distilling under vacuum, you're lowering the temperature at which the alcohol will boil, and you can really select the temperature at which you want the different, you know, you want the different botanicals to be distilling at. And what's beautiful about that is that you're actually able to really fraction what you're looking for. So we don't have any citrus in the gin, but the juniper is distilled at around 40 to 45 degrees, which means that you're kind of really getting out some lovely citrusy notes of it without the pininess. The honey is distilled at 65 degrees, which really means that you're extracting this lovely, rich, floral, slightly spicy and buttery honey perfume.
What sort of drinks does it work best in?
One of the things that I learned when I got involved with Miko, when we started, you know, working on this together, everything that Miko creates is really born from experimentation. And as I think he alluded to earlier, it's sort of not following the rules. There are no rules to this. You can be creative with gin, especially. And so to answer the question, James, we try and encourage people just to play with it. It's a really playful spirit. I mean, yes, there are recommendations. I personally love pink pepper gin in a Negroni, in a French 75. It makes a beautiful gin and tonic with a point of difference. But really, it's play with it. You know, tonics, especially at the moment, we work exclusively with Fever Tree. There's such a range of tonics. And as a rule, you know, it would just be, if you've got a premium spirit, have a premium mixer. And the range of tonics, really, there's something there to suit your taste buds. So just play around with it. You know, neither Miko nor I are barmen, so it's kind of doesn't feel right saying, here, make this.
No. Ian will again kill me for saying this, but the one drink that I really am not a fan of pink pepper in is a dry martini. That's one thing. But don't put that in. There's no need to talk down the spirit.
Actually, do you know what? No, go for it. Put it in, because again, that comes back to the whole point of experimentation. I happen to love it in a martini. Miko is less of a fan, which actually is one of the reasons which led on to a limited edition product that we did, which was pink pepper dry gin, which is perfect in a martini.
And so, Ian, when you did manage to get pink pepper into Selfridges, getting something ranged is kind of half the battle. You've then got to make sure that people buy it. So what was the next stage like in that regard?
Quite naively, I didn't think that far ahead with it. You know, it was almost a kind of field of dreams moment. I just sort of thought, you know, if you build it, they will come kind of thing, and that we'd list in Selfridges and that's it. You know, that's we're done. We're made. But of course, no, the reality is it takes a lot of time. You need to be on the ground. You need to stand in the stores in Selfridges at the start, and subsequently in other, you know, we're now listed in Waitrose, which is a supermarket chain in the UK, and you need to stand in the store and do tastings for several hours, and you just need to continue to talk about the product and get as many people to try it as possible, you know, without meaning to sound overly commercial on it. That's the job, you know, to get liquid on lips.
slowly but surely you did get some traction, obviously, because they wouldn't still be ranging it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first and foremost, it comes down to the quality of the spirit. It is a really crowded industry, and you need to have something that has quality behind it, and the way that it's made, the way that it's created, and again, the playfulness of it. And it's quite satisfying after a while. There was a period where I knew every bar in the UK that stocked Pink Pepper Gin or, you know, any of the other spirits that we were doing at the time, because I had sold it into them. And then gradually you start to see it in bars that I'd never been in or visited. And that's really rewarding, because you know then that it's starting to find a life of its own. And obviously behind that, you know, we work really hard, or I do all of our social media, and, you know, we didn't have budgets, James. There wasn't, you know, this was at that period was just Miko and I, and we were, you know, just doing what we could, but we didn't have marketing spend or anything like that at our disposal. So it was all really through Instagram, Facebook. We would support, and we still do, we support, you know, events that are sort of close to Miko and I. So we for several years, we sponsored the London Jazz Festival, but we sponsor them with spirits, not financially. We support the British Film Institute. And basically that's because Miko and I love both jazz and film. I don't think you'd ever see Pink Pepper Gin sponsoring any kind of sporting event, because I don't think either of us are particularly interested in support in sport. But it's a really good way for us to, again, to share. We call it sharing the pink pepper love. Sorry if that sounds cheesy, but that's what we call it. So, you know, we share the pink pepper love by getting the liquid to as many people as we possibly can. And that sort of led on, because obviously I live in France, but I was traveling, and, you know, prior to COVID, would be traveling regularly back and forth to various different places. But really, it became clear that we needed somebody else on the ground to be there all the time in the UK, which is what led us to start working with Pip. She sort of carries on that, doing all the tastings, speaking to bars, you know, getting it on cocktail lists and working in that way.
And so the business has obviously grown pretty substantially over the last few years?
Business has grown, I guess, apart from last year where COVID hit and things were difficult, I think, for a lot of businesses, including us. We've grown every year since the beginning. And not only financially, but also the spread and the reach of the spirits that we create, the range of different spirits that we create, going from just gin to liqueurs and bitters, and now kind of entering into spirits that aren't categorizable. And obviously we entered into Australia, my home country, a few years ago with some great guys, excellent importers, Mind Spirits, Michael and Arturo, who are really spreading the love, the pink pepper love, and in Australia, which is just wonderful. So I think that, you know, just every year there's this, you know, there's a real respiration of real breathing of and growth of the world that we're creating. And that's just a really wonderful thing to experience.
You mentioned that gin hadn't really taken off in France around, you know, at the time when you started the distillery. What's been the evolution of gin production and appreciation in France since then?
It's been absolutely wonderful to witness, to be honest with you. So when we set up, when I set up in 2013, Citadel, made by Maison Ferrand, had been around for a number of years. You know, there were really precursors in over here. Givine, made by Maison Villevert, had kind of been around for a few years as well. Other than that, there were like a few scattered productions that were done, but really nothing very concrete. We started in 2013 and started commercializing in 2014. And we were really, really newcomers on the block. And obviously, back in the UK, the gin boom was in full swing, which is what really allowed us to kind of grow, because we hitched onto the UK market. So over here in France, it took maybe until about 2016 for gin to really, really enter into the conscious minds of consumers. The bar scene really started to develop at that time. There was a distillery that set up in the center of Paris called La Distillerie de Paris, that create experimental and really, really beautiful spirits as well. And that got a lot of publicity. And I think that it was that moment there was really the turning point where people realized that gin wasn't just this, you know, spirit to be relegated to the back of a cupboard, but really had something interesting and really you could create a lot of different things with it. So kind of 2016, things started to pick up, and then the micro distillery boom followed suit, because it's really a, you know, gin is a really great tool to be able to develop commercially. There's a market that is open. Very often, and it's for better or for worse, gin is used as a sort of tool to finance whiskey production. Whiskey, you know, France is the biggest single malt market in the world, I think. So they're massive whiskey consumers, quite ironically being Armagnac and Cognac producers. But so whiskey distilling and micro distilleries creating whiskey really started to pick up, which meant that gin was starting to be produced as well. And now there are literally hundreds of distilleries around France that are creating gin and different spirits. You know, France has an incredible history and tie with spirits. There are hundreds of distilleries that have existed for literally hundreds of years that are creating old school and very beautiful old style liqueurs, eau de vie, and they're really, really localized. They sell really locally. And I think that once gin kind of entered into the conscious minds of people, a lot of distilleries reacted to that and created gin to their own style. So a lot of the you know, if there were in the Burgundy region where there are you know, there's a lot of winemaking and a lot of fruit eau de vie and fruit liqueurs that are made there. There are several distilleries that are set up that are using local botanicals and local fruits to create their spirits. You know, and that sort of evolution was really, really, really interesting to witness. And today, you know, where there are shops that are specialty shops on gin, and there's a whole movement for it, which is it's wonderful to be a part of. But it's it's a tiny bit ridiculous because you know, we're quite a young company. We've been around since 2014, but we're literally considered the old kids on the block here. It's quite funny that we're considered to be a well-established and old brand, in inverted commas, in the gin market.
It is quite strange. You know, everything that flows from Ordinary Spirits really is created in Miko's living room. And it's always, you know, we are a really small outfit, and really everything comes from Miko's passion for all of this. And it's always, it just strikes me as really strange sometimes to be considered as this sort of company when really it does all flow from the living room.
I think I've seen a picture of you there, Miko, and it looks a bit like a rustic chemist lab or something like that. There's a lot of test tubes and beakers and all that kind of stuff there.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one. So yeah, definitely, as Ian was saying, it really is in my living room, and it does look like a rustic chemistry lab. I think that's the perfect way of describing it, James. Yeah, so it is quite amusing to be considered, you know, well established and an authority on gin and spirits of this kind in France. When yes, it does all just flow from my living room.
And I mean, you know, it is genuinely there is one side that is the laboratory, and you know, there's this mad professor in the middle of it, and then the other side is the sofa. You know, I can't stress enough that's where everything comes from. And often people think, well, yeah, but it's not really your living room, is it? And it's like, no, it really is.
Yeah, and a lot of people think, because you know, we've got a pretty good production. You know, as the scale is, you know, we're, for a small distillery, we produce quite a bit of spirits, and just there's I think there's a bit of disbelief that that all of it can come from the living room.
Is there a crunch time approaching for you guys where you're going to have to look at scaling up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, to be perfectly honest with you, crunch time has kind of been and gone. crunch time was about 3 years ago. So we are working on scaling up, and we've actually got an incredibly exciting project that is underway. It's nothing is signed yet, but we're kind of really working on doing the development of building a distillery, actually just next door to some good friends and a partner distillery that we work with, where we're going to be able to work in tandem with them. So they're a cognac distillery, and we're going to be able to kind of recycle their hot water to heat our stills it's something that is in the works at the moment.
We found an incredible architect, having met with a few architects. We found someone that really, you know, when I first met Miko, this is a mad professor almost, and the space in which he works really needs to. Sorry, Miko, I'm going to talk about you as though you're not here. But you know, we often refer to this space as Miko's mind room, and to find an architect that actually could take what the space needs to be, and put it into a design was firstly quite a challenge to find them, but secondly, when you do find that person, it was amazing. And they've done an incredible job with the designs, and it's more about. So Pink Pepper Gin is obviously the flagship, the guardian of the range of Audemars Spirits. But again, coming back to the sort of ethos of Audemars Spirits is about creativity, and it is about this passion for creativity. And so to expand into a different space is actually to allow us to not spend, or to allow Miko to not spend all of his time just producing Pink Pepper Gin and the other flagship ranges, because that actually sort of stifles the creative process for other things. So by expanding, by, you know, it's not about, I suppose what I'm trying to say is, it's not about expanding to the point so we can sell more gin. It's more about streamlining what we do so that we can then focus on other things and getting creative in other spirits, and just continue to follow the passion, really, James.
And are you packaging at home as well, or do you do that off-site somewhere?
No.
So there are several things on that. So we in Cognac, we're right in the heart of the town of Cognac, or the city, I should say. But we are surrounded by everything to do with the industry. So there's what's called the Spirits Valley, which is it's basically a recruitment of bottlers, of warehouses for storing alcohol, of distilleries, of bottle makers, of cork makers, of label makers, of kind of the filtered spring water that is local. There is everything for the industry that is set up in a radius of about 5 kilometers around Cognac, and obviously it goes much more than 5 kilometers, but within a 5 kilometer range, we've got all the partners we need to be able to create our spirits. So the core of the distillation, or the value added side of our spirits production, is done in my living room. But then we have partners off site, just a couple of kilometers away, where we do the blending, where we do the filtration, and another site, which is about literally 900 meters away from the distillery, where we do the bottling, the storing, and kind of all the logistics. So we are streamlined for the value added side, and then work with really, really close partners to do those different elements. And to kind of touch on what Ian was saying as well, in terms of what we're looking to do, the importance of having our own site is really to be able to bring all of those, a lot of those different elements onto one site, so that it's easier to manage, it's easier to do the blending and the bottling, and organize, being able to be more organized. And then being able to go into different things and explore different spirits, that's really the aim.
Best of luck with it, guys. It's been a really fun chat. You've got a really interesting story.
Thank you very much, James. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yes, ditto. I echo those words. Thank you, James.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson. Like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.